How can I see the light when it's so dark? Journey to a Thankful Heart. On this broadcast, we'll be talking about the belief in gratitude. It reminds me of a beautiful verse from Psalm 27, verse 13. I believe that I shall see the goodness of the Lord in the land of the living. There's also a quote from Ralph Waldo Emerson that teaches us a lot about belief and gratitude. He said this, "All I have seen teaches me to trust the Creator for all I have not seen." It seems to me that beliefs are a bit like the blinker signal on a car. They indicate the direction toward which we're moving. They point us down a path and give impetus to the journey we're on. Beliefs, that is, tenets that we hold to be true, don't transform our hearts in and of themselves, but they certainly open the way for spiritual energy to deepen and take root in us. Despite all experiential evidence to the contrary, traditional wisdom and scripture urge us to steer our spiritual growth toward thanksgiving. But sometimes the meanness of man, as well as the messiness of Mother Nature, seem more visible in our lives than the goodness of the Lord for which the psalmist yearns. As we are bombarded with daily reports of murder and mayhem, it's difficult to remember, much less to believe, that we are wired for gratitude. But the medical, scientific, and psychological evidence is piling up. Books and studies affirm the value of this virtue of gratitude, telling us that we not only need thankfulness, but also that we may even be wired for it, because it's a state of the soul that enhances both health and happiness, and even longevity, according to a study reported on the TV show 2020 some years ago. 100 active centenarians from cultures around the globe were interviewed to determine any common characteristics they might share. There were 4 attributes that outdistanced all the rest in this study. In short, they were simple daily mobility and physical activity, like walking to the mailbox. The second thing, being engaged in a passion and something that one loves to do. Third, the ability to let go, to adjust to loss. And fourth, an optimistic, grateful attitude. Now, not all of us may want to live to be 100 years old, but if we do, the quality of those extended years will be much better if thanksgiving is threaded through our days. And we aren't the only ones. Look at the instinctive behavior of animals. Those of you who have pets know what it's like to hear your cat purr or see the dog wag his tail when he sees you coming. And then there's the instinctive behavior of children. And this appreciation that we're talking about is very much evident in their unscripted responses. The way they are naturally grateful before the experiences of life have chipped away at their innocence. We often travel the road to maturity at the expense of losing childhood's unbridled delight, that sense of arms flung wide open to the world. Did you ever wonder how we lose these wonderful responses along the way? Perhaps the spontaneous smiles of children can help us to be led to a renewed belief in the power of gratitude. First, though, before we consider this natural impulse and all its nuances, let's think for a moment about what gratitude is not. Now, first off, gratitude is not gullibility. Many of us want to say with Pippa in that famous poem by Robert Browning, God's in his heaven, all's right with the world. As I said previously, For years, I accepted the popular definition of gratitude as the recurrent affirmation of what's working in our lives. But the question that we all ask, if we're thinking deeply, is what are we going to do with all the things that aren't working? So the intellectual tension begins to build, that persistent wedge that exists between positive thinking and the reality we experience. As a kid, I was taught in Sunday school to give thanks in all circumstances, and really, it sounded like Mission Impossible to me. Inevitably, I just became accustomed to the disconnect between what I heard on Sunday and what I experienced on Monday. The renowned writer Henry Nouwen expressed the dilemma this way. He said this, "How often we tend to divide our past into good things to remember with gratitude and painful things to accept or forget. We develop a mentality in which we hope to collect more good memories than bad ones. But gratitude, as the gospel speaks about it, embraces all of life, the good and the bad, the joyful and the painful, the holy and the not so holy." We prevent ourselves often from discovering the joy beneath our sorrow, the peace hidden in the midst of conflict, the strength that becomes visible in the midst of weakness. As long as we remain resentful about things that we wish had not happened, about relationships that we wish had turned out differently, and mistakes we wish we hadn't made, part of our heart remains isolated, unable to bear fruit in the new life ahead of us. Wise words by Henry Nouwen. So, though we can't erase the reality of random tragedy or unexpected illness or daily disappointments, we can choose to be thankful in them, if not for them. We may indeed be urged to offer to God a sacrifice of thanksgiving, as we're called to in Psalm 50. But we are not called to sacrifice our honesty. Joy and sorrow and healing and pain are sides of the same coin in all our pockets. Mourning and dancing are part of the same movement. We must remember that gratitude is born when our heart says yes to the lesson that God has granted in all the occasions of life and is speaking to us through them. The second thing gratitude is not guilt. We've all heard about guilt trips. Well, these guilt trips start early in life and we just keep on taking them over and over. Did your mother ever tell you to eat all your vegetables and remember the starving children in foreign countries? Many of our mothers said that with authority, and somehow I never quite understood what that had to do with those canned English peas, but I just ate them anyway, choking with guilt. Or what about when we say or hear others say, "I'm thankful that God spared me in the auto accident last week. My buddy didn't make it." Or, "Just look at all my blessings. I really should be more grateful," my friend said shamefully. Our memory banks are full of similar statements that we all make, attesting to the fact that gratitude is sometimes tinged with guilt. Strangely enough, this kind of reasoning is often where we begin our journey toward a thankful heart. But hopefully it isn't where we end that journey, because the implication is that no matter how genuine the gratitude, it comes to us at someone else's expense. The person with no food or no home or no worthwhile life. The unspoken message is that at least we are better off than they are. Thirdly, gratitude is not grandiosity. We tend to say things like, "God blessed us with a cloudless day for the patio party." Or, "I was so grateful for God's protection on that stormy flight to Chicago." Or, "Our company has been blessed with huge profits." While statements such as these are all too human, We need to hear the tinge of entitlement that lurks underneath the sentiments. What are we really saying here? That the nearby farmer who needed rain on the day of the patio party was not blessed while we were? Or that the plane that crashed while mine stayed aloft was full of folks who were outside the realm of God's protection? Or are the owners of failing companies somehow out of favor with God? The unspoken implications of some of our thankful words hint at a hidden arrogance. In some cases, there's the notion that somehow we deserved it or that God must have thought we deserved it. Author Christina Baldwin writes these words, "There are no guarantees in life. Good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people. Being spiritual doesn't save us from anything. But being spiritual allows us to hold whatever happens in a spiritual way." One glimpse into the complexity of this problem will remind us that any glib talk about the mystery of suffering is as ludicrous as trying to square a circle. Strictly speaking, the problem is insoluble. As I stated previously, part of me likes the popular definition of gratitude as the recurrent affirmation of what's working, because it's a simple, uncluttered meaning. But the deeper part of me knows that it's too one-sided. It omits the powerful potential for blessing contained in that which is not working. In our privileged culture, we tend to see blessing confined to that which gets good results, that which produces happiness and prosperity. As we move toward a more profound understanding of gratitude, we must be willing to include the wholeness of life journey, both the light and the dark, and the holy potential in each. Now that we've examined some of our causal and our casual notions of gratitude, let's look more deeply, more closely, at some of its other dimensions. For one thing, gratitude is grounding. Paul Tillich's name for reality was the ground of all being. These days, science is affirming the sacred. We think of the field of science as being concrete, reliable, dependable, and grounding. There's a growing number of studies from sources such as quantum physics and the behavioral sciences, all of which are saying that gratitude is good for us. Their empirical evidence helps to ground us in something solid and sustaining and, yes, even sacred. Though the nature of the universe is being expressed in scientific terms that may be new to us, there's a familiar ring to it that goes back centuries. It even echoes underlying truths found in the scripture, such as Mark 11:24, which reads, "So I tell you, whatever you ask for in prayer, believe that you have received it, and it will be yours." And there are similar tenets in other wisdom traditions. The corroboration of science lends validation and grounding to these beliefs. Now, I must confess, I'm no scientist. But even as a novice, I can no longer avoid considering the exciting implications in the arena of quantum physics, which I barely understand. I'll try to summarize in layman's language the bits and pieces that I've been able to understand so far. Obviously, there are many unseen forces out there, invisible to our eyes, but undeniably powerful. There are layers of existence that contain electromagnetic energy and vibrational frequencies, and all of this is part of the reality that we live with every single day. Though I may not understand the science of it, I can't deny the fact that I can pick up my cell phone in Memphis, Tennessee, and in seconds be talking to someone in Tokyo. We are surrounded by fields of pulsating energy, and are somehow mysteriously part of it. Here's where it gets personal. Studies are also showing the measured effects on this electromagnetic field generated by human emotion. Emotions that emit certain vibrations. We are created in such a remarkable way that intentions such as compassion, peace, love, appreciation emit a higher vibration than emotions such as resentment, jealousy, anger, complaint, and negativity. And we influence the energy field around us by the vibrations we introduce. And at the same time, we are influenced by that unified field. Our thoughts produce feelings, feelings produce energy, energy affects experience. The invisible effect extends even to other systems in the created order. Suggestions such as sing to your plants or pet your cat are far from merely trivial remarks. As human beings, we experience this connection in many ways that we take for granted. When we observe someone else's finger jabbed with a pin, our own cells react. Or consider the familiar term that we've all heard, helper's high, which refers to a phenomenon in which a pleasurable vibration is felt by both people when we are good to each other. It's as if we are hardwired to respond to kindness. Now, the implications that all life is connected in this web of feeling are mind-blowing, but they're not new. If our thoughts and feelings do indeed affect ourselves and others in ways that may now seem mysterious to us, it becomes imperative that we take responsibility for this by monitoring our own thoughts and words. Paul tells the Philippians in Philippians 4:8, "Finally, beloved, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is pleasing, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, and if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." Now, many branches of medical science are joining this chorus also. If my mind is anxious, upset, angry, over sustained periods of time, there are corresponding chemical changes in my body and in my immune system. However, long-term stress, we are told, is not caused by an experience itself with its accompanying human reactions, but rather our interpretation and response to the experience over a long period of time. There's a harmony to all this, and gratitude is one of the keys that unlocks our willingness to join that divine harmony, and it fits into a sacred pattern somehow. We are also told that gratitude is grace. While gratitude is sometimes a thank you for something specific, it's most deeply realized through a grace-filled process that simply happens. I referred to this in our first broadcast. I said that I had an experience that showed me just how feelings of thanksgiving can bubble up unbidden. And here's that experience. There was a dark moment a few weeks before the deadline when this new book on gratitude was due. And I was ready to throw in the towel. I had sabotaged my own writing with uncharacteristic procrastination. And that lack of discipline, along with a busy speaking schedule, had landed me in such a time crunch that I was on a 5:30 a.m. writing regimen in hopes of getting the manuscript done by the deadline, which I, frankly, had already renegotiated three times. Every time I sat down in front of the computer, the sense of urgency felt like a huge dam that was holding back the creative flow. I was stuck or blocked or jammed or whatever you want to call it. I was at some sort of impasse. Well, I wasn't planning to attend our Writers' group meeting that day. After all, I needed to be writing instead, didn't I? But I couldn't wait to get out of my office and go somewhere, anywhere. There were only four of us in attendance that day, which was a light crowd. That plus the gifted young creative writing instructor whose purpose it was to lead us patiently through the terrain of writing. I had emailed the first draft of the introduction in chapter one of the book and asked all of them for feedback. But so far only one person had replied, a grammar whiz in our group who had emailed her corrections before leaving on a trip, so she wasn't at our group meeting that day. No one had commented on the content of the book. So when the subject of my book project came up on the agenda, there was this palpable silence and hesitation around the table. Finally, someone said haltingly, "Well, Linda, this chapter sounds like a school report, an academic exercise, not like you." Then another one chimed in, "Yeah, like you were taking an exam or something, or writing a term paper." With a sad sigh, I added under my breath, and I was trying to get an A. Then their caring comments came tumbling out. There was affirmation for my research and my citing of good, reliable sources, but there was also frank talk about there being too many of them and not enough of my own experience. There was assurance on the one hand that yes, I was a pretty good writer, but I wasn't speaking clearly in this paragraph or in that one. But their final consensus was they didn't hear the heartbeat that they usually associated with my work. So they cited instances and examples, and I took notes, and at last someone summed up the discussion with this parting question. "Linda, where was your voice, your real voice, in this writing?" Well, to tell you the truth, I limped home in a deeper hole than ever. How in the world could I complete this book on time if I did all the major rewrites that they were talking about? There was no way I had time to start all over. I was so upset that I put it all aside in frustration for the rest of the evening and just plumped down in front of the TV and watched an old movie. But something strange happened by the next morning. As I was sitting with a cup of coffee, something unexpected began to surface, something I didn't engineer nor expect. As I took time to sit reflectively with my disappointment and discouragement, there were feelings of hope and even gratitude that began to bubble up out of nowhere. Was hearing the criticism of my work a pleasant experience? Was I happy about it? Did it feel good? No. Applause definitely feels better. Then what was this unbidden burst of gratitude all about? Suddenly I knew. Underneath all the critiques was a profound sense of being valued, not only as a writer, but as a human being. They had cared enough about my work to go through it with a fine-toothed comb. They had cared enough about me to risk telling me the truth. And if that isn't a cause for thanksgiving, I don't know what is. The last point I want to make about gratitude is that gratitude grows. It feeds on itself. You remember the familiar story of the loaves and the fishes from Matthew 15. Where Jesus took the seven loaves and the two fish, and after giving thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and then the disciples dispersed them to the crowds. Well, just like the loaves and the fishes, gratitude grows. The more one says thank you, the more one sees things for which to give thanks. It's a beautiful truth that thanksgiving is contagious. Being around grateful people makes us more likely to catch this delightful disease. Years ago, I had a friend whom I'll call Cindy. She lived in the throes of a pattern that I've called Yes But, and I wrote about it lots in the other book, How Can I Let Go If I Don't Know I'm Holding On? A pattern called Yes But. Any positive happening in her world was inevitably second-guessed. If she had had a pleasant visit from her grandchildren, her focus was on the backache she suffered as a result and how tired she was. If you complimented some accomplishment of hers, she couldn't say a simple thank you. She had to tell you what was wrong with it and why you shouldn't have thought that. Hey, have you ever been around folks like this who, perhaps in an effort to appear humble, have forgotten to be grateful? They deny themselves and others the mutual experience of gratitude. And I don't know about you, but being around them sucks the energy right out of my system. I'm always inspired by the ability of some folks to see reality clearly, then move on to a positive place without the irritating chirpiness that distinguishes a Pollyanna attitude. With a mysterious contagion, gratitude spreads like wonderful wildfire, because genuine thanksgiving feeds itself exponentially. And experience shows this. Think about it. People who are thanked when they give directions are more likely to help others in the future. Studies even show that waiters who write thank you on the check receive larger tips. The point is that gratitude begets more gratitude. It's as if the more we see, the more our sight is shaped by the seeing. So spiritual wisdom is telling us, through science, through religion, and through experience, that gratitude matters. But belief in gratitude is a beginning point. Remember at the beginning of this broadcast, I said that belief was like a blinker signal on the car. It points us in a direction, but it's not the destination itself. It doesn't settle things. Rather, it propels us forward in trust. And so as we dare to believe in the worth of gratitude, and in this journey to a thankful heart, let's move with it. Let's take a deep breath and see where it takes us.